No. Be afraid. Be very afraid.
There's nothing to fear except God. Whatever that means to you.
Do I look like someone who cares what God thinks?
You're listening to a podcast exploring faith and fear, what scares us and what saves us. This is The Fear of God.
Hello and welcome back to the Fear of God podcast. Find all your favorite foggy paraphernalia at thefearofgodpodcast.com. Every week here in the fog, we explore what scares us to find what saves us. And by we, I mean me, one of your hosts, Nathan Rouse.
And me, your other host, Reed Lackey.
Reed.
Hi, dude.
Welcome.
How you doing?
I'm so glad, you know, that it is just you and me here today talking about this movie that's very wrapped up in ideas, crucial and critical and central to our persons and identity, right? I'm just kidding. We'll get to that in a second. Today, we are cranking up the electricity for a series, frankly, all about me. I'm just kidding. Frank and Nathan, the fog persona. If you look at our website, if you look at our stuff on iTunes and whatnot, you'll see the Frank and Nathan character. It actually is not about me. I can set myself aside momentarily as someone talking on a microphone only can. But we are in the midst of a mini series called Frankly, My Dear, a series of conversations examining adaptations of the Frankenstein mythology in films both old and brand new. Last week, we chopped off some bits with Lisa Frankenstein. And this week, we'll be having a rather awkward public bathroom meetup with the film Birth Rebirth. Joining us is longtime.
Oh my God.
Joining us. Hey, I didn't make the movie. I just report on it. Joining us is longtime fogger, because it is not just you and me today, Reed. Thank God. Longtime fogger, Vera Gowdy, and recent friend, last appearing on our Evil Dead Rise discussion, it is No Way Jose herself, Jose Worley. Vera, Jose, welcome back to the party.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yes, absolutely. Now, the funny part here is Reed and I are just going to turn off our mics and let y'all...
we need to introduce you, and we're just going to back away.
I'm just functioning as MC here. You know, Reed's got a raspy voice. Nothing going on here, but yes.
So this is one of those rare cases where we're not going to do like a patron segment or anything like that. We're just going to dive right in. I feel like the film kind of deserves it. So why don't we just get right, about this movie? IMDb describes Birth Rebirth this way. A morgue technician successfully reanimates the body of a little girl, but to keep her breathing, she will need to harvest biological materials from pregnant women. When the girl's mother, a nurse, discovers her baby alive, they enter into a deal that forces them both down a dark path of no return. So, you know,
wow.
Superficial.
Stuff, yeah.
Yeah.
I am going to go ahead and interject here that I am actually glad I did not read that before watching this movie. I didn't read anything. I didn't watch a trailer. So even though I know empirically, because I co-program with Reed, that we're in the midst of a Frankenstein series, I wasn't really thinking about any of it. And you didn't mean to come to me first, but I'm commenting, Reed, on what you just read, which is to say, when the child passes in the film, I was like, oh my God. You know, now that's, Reed, that's when I texted you like, this is heavy and dark. Now I'm not gonna say they pull the punch, that's not what I mean, but it does soften the blow a little bit when you're like, Frankenstein, got it, okay. Now I'm tracking with you. Anyway, I just wanted to interject and interrupt to comment on the fact that what you just read is, you know, it tells a lot, and I'm glad I didn't know it before watching the movie.
While we're with you, why don't you go ahead and share, like, what'd you think? What'd you feel about it?
Okay, fine.
You said it pulled the punch, and then
me, but it,
All I meant was you said it pulled the punch, and then that was only to rear back to slobber knocker you like right in the side of the head. That's what this film does.
That's a word. Indeed.
Sorry. Yes, I'll let you talk. That's a wrestling word right there.
That's okay.
They call it a slobber knocker. It's where it hits you so hard, you spit flies across the ring. Yeah, that's right. That's the one.
I get it.
I love Reed. I'm gonna start doing that. I'm so impressed with us just there, Reed, like our communication skills after 20 years plus years of friendship, where you know I was trying to move on in my sentence and you were interjecting, then you said I'm trying to make a joke, and then I was like, okay, well I'm gonna let you make that joke. So I'm gonna start, just so you know, and I'm gonna start doing that, by the way.
I knew that was the code word. That's like, this is the key that I need to turn.
Let me sit back and I want to hear. I want to laugh.
Wow.
Wow.
Okay. So, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. And to be fair, I actually don't think the film pulls its punch once you understand, okay, this is text of the film. I don't know what it says about me these days, but last week on our conversation about Lisa Frankenstein and several other lighthearted romps lately, I'm like, don't give me lighthearted. Drag me through the muck and the darkness and the drama of life and death and rebirth and birth and rebirth, you know. And so there was a world where turning this on, I was like, I'm vibing on this, you know. It's kind of my jam. Dark drama, Carla from Scrubs, you know.
Life always took a turn after she divorced Turk, I guess.
Yeah. Still in nursing though, so there you go.
I was trying to think of where I had recognized this lady. I was like, I feel like I've seen her, but I know it wasn't something that serious, and I couldn't think of it. And I actually just rewatched it a little bit ago with one of my friends over Discord, and he was like, oh, that girl, that chick's from Scrubs. And I was like, oh my God, that's where she's from.
Yes, indeed. And so it was a real pleasure to see her. Hmm? What?
Somebody did that, mm-hmm, which is like the theme song for the Scrubs Rewatch podcast does that.
Wow.
Oh, yeah, we're getting
scrubbed up in here, you know. Okay, so I was talking and
this,
you don't know how much that feeds my soul to see people do that in my direction. Just listen with rapt attention. Birth, dial it in here, y'all. You know that feeling when you watch a movie sometimes and you're kind of, you know, again, as I described a minute ago, you're kind of on the wavelength, and then it does this thing where you're like, oh snap, now I don't totally get it, but I kind of love it. So when this movie in its last, 5 minutes, 7 minutes resets what you didn't know you were watching was in the future, or is it in the past, or is it birth, or is it rebirth? Like when that happened, I was like, oh, all right, I dig it. You know, this is, my brain can't get it yet, but I dig it. So you know, to say one enjoys this film is an odd word to apply to it on a certain level. But in terms of how it does what it does, I really took a lot out of. So, yeah, that's me. Who's next?
Awesome.
Who wants to share their experience of the film Birth, Rebirth?
Jose, I will invite you as our more recent guest. Had you seen this film before? I don't think I knew.
Yes, I had seen it before only once. And like I said, I just rewatched it like an hour ago.
yeah
like right before the pod, just because I like having fresh, you know, fresh eyes, because it's easy for me to forget small stuff in horror movies, and this is like barely horror, honestly. Like it definitely has dark themes for sure, but I wouldn't even like to consider this horror. It's kind of like but anyways, where was I going with that? See, brain, this is why I have to rewatch. I was talking about rewatching. So I have to rewatch because I need fresh eyes, because I forget stuff. And in horror, there's little things that you'll notice it, but after a month, 2 months of not seeing it, you'll forget about that little thing that you thought was so cool, right? So that's why I wanted to go back, and I have my notes and stuff for you know, just in case or whatever. But overall, I loved this. I really did. As a woman, especially a woman post Roe v. Wade, a woman who has undergone sexual assault, there's a lot of things that kind of go through your mind when you see movies like this. It as a woman, I think it definitely touches you in a very different way than it would a male facing person or a biological male. Yes. And I appreciate subtlety, and there was a lot of things, like, as I was rewatching it, that I noticed, like, yeah, they're not telling you everything about this. Like, it was never clarified, like, whether the two main chicks were, like, in a relationship by the end, like, if that was going to be a thing. They never even had a clear, true, like, solid and like closure even. But I kind of appreciate when directors take that step. And even further on this, like, whole female thing, it very much felt like a very feminist movie to me.
Yes.
The director is also female. What was her name again? Laura Moss.
Laura Moss.
Mm-hmm. She's also female. And I think having, you know, obviously this is a riff, kind of like a new age Frankenstein, as you had spoken of earlier. Even though I think it more closely resembles Reanimator, which is kind of funny, but so for those familiar with that movie, I think it's a lot like that. Obviously not silly. It goes in the complete opposite direction, but
right.
But yeah, I think just some of the topics that were hit on, just very important things. The fact that the main, you know, and I mean, we'll get it. I don't know how this conversation is going to devolve, but just, I mean, it just feels like there's so many things in it that lead back to, this is important for women. This is important for women. This is like, so many things in it. And I think that's why it feels so powerful to me. And I'm glad that it was made. It feels like a very important movie to me.
Sure. Let me jump in there real quick. Because I want to ask you a question and then have a comment. For you, you mentioned, you know, you'd seen it before, and sounds like, you know, not recently before this, today's viewing. For you, as you view films, like, are you just like, if it's horror or cataloged or categorized as such, I'm just going to watch it because that's what I do? Or had something tipped you off to have watched this particular one? Like, how did this one hit the radar for you
originally? So I am a big fan of Shudder, just in general.
Sure. Yeah.
And so when I hear there's a movie that's heavily promoted by Shudder, or other people I know who have Shudder suggest a movie, that's usually when I'm like, okay, this is probably going to be a good one.
Yeah.
And there were several people in my kind of spooky circle who were like, hey, have you seen Birth Rebirth yet? And I was like, oh yeah, I had heard of the title, and I've seen, like, you know, the image, like the main poster that pops up everywhere. And they're like, you have got to see it. And even down to the fact, I didn't even think about this. I literally have Frankenstein stuff behind me right now. But Mary Shelley is a female, the creator of Frankenstein, right? And also, like, I mentioned the fact that the relationship is kind of left ambiguous in terms of whether it's, like, going to be a thing or not in the future. But you know, Mary Shelley was bisexual. And so I think that the fact that both of the characters in this story and them being so close together and in a living space together was very intentional in that regard as well. I think they were touching on that specifically.
Well, and you alluded to the director. I today, and I'm interjecting this comment as an umbrella sort of concept as we move forward in this conversation, and then Vera coming to you here. But today I was watching an interview from Sundance where when it premiered there, and it was the director and then all the three actresses, you know, Cecilia, and then I can't remember.
Maren Ireland.
Yes, I was thinking of her. I was trying to think of her character name, but I couldn't conjure.
Rose.
Yes, her.
Oh, Rose. Rose. Dr. Casper.
And then the patient that recurs a couple times. And Emily. It was really fascinating.
Yeah.
Laura Moss, the director, shared this really interesting note in what I was able to watch of this interview. I didn't have time for the whole thing, but really fascinating, worth checking out. Maybe I'll throw it in the notes when we post this episode. She said she'd had the idea for the film, or for what became the film, even as a teenager, like that far back. And she's probably, if not late 30s, or if not early 40s, late 30s, somewhere in there. And her note was that the core conceit was, and to your point, Jose, about this being a very feminist film, like the core conceit was a Frankenstein story where the evil doctor, or the doctor performing the act of creation, was utilizing their own body's processes as the stepping stones for the creation. And I just found that kind of endlessly imaginative and fascinating, but I wanted to insert that here as a kind of overarching idea as we move into the fuller conversation about the film. But Vera, coming to you, like, you know, were you familiar with the film before this conversation? Had you seen it before now? And what did you think in this particular viewing, or when you first saw it?
No, I had not seen it. I feel like I may have heard of it or seen something regarding it, but I didn't know what it was about. And I usually go into the movie preferring it that way anyway. Mm-hmm. And I am on a similar page in that I like, enjoy is not the correct word, but I appreciated the exercise of watching the movie. I think it has a lot on its mind in terms of the like vulnerability of being pregnant and motherhood and the things that come along with that. And so I think it is a very important twist to the, and addition to the Frankenstein sort of catalog.
Yeah. Reed, nice. What about you?
So I had heard about this film and was, and feel, you know, I'm going to confess this next thing, you know, rather ashamedly. I had heard about the film and largely dismissed whether or not I would see it by the title. I know this is a silly thing to say, but like, I saw the birth / rebirth and I was like, I ain't gonna be interested in that. It's just like, why are you gonna put a big slash mark right in the middle of the title? I'm not interested in that. But like, kind of like Jose was mentioning, it kept coming up on a whole bunch of little lists I was following, people saying like, oh man, sleeper, you know, great film over here that everybody should be checking out. And I do, I've loved Shudder for a few years now, and I can't ever keep pace with this, but I try as I'm able to whenever they usually release like one, maybe two new films a week. They're not always on that same pace, but whenever they do, I try, if I can, during that week to try to check the film out. Birth, Rebirth initially missed me, but when so many people were praising it, I was like, okay, fine, I'll check this out. And it was in December when there was a slew of, I'm just trying to squeeze a bunch of films in that I think maybe I should know about to see, you know, for my rankings for the year and everything like that. And I watched this film amidst a slew of others and could not get it off my mind. It wound up, I placed it as my fifth favorite horror film of last year. I was really blown away by it. I thought it was incredibly smart. When you say that the director was like thinking about this film since high school, I was like, it feels that way. This feels mm-hmm. like a story yeah. that has been digested, thought through, torn apart. Every decision is critical and thoughtful. There's nothing, I think, at all that is slapdash about this film. This is a mm-hmm. film that, even if it doesn't connect with you as an audience member, even if it's a bit too transgressive, even if it's a bit too juggling too many subjects at once, I don't think anybody can walk away from this film and think that it was like, you know, not well put together and not meticulously constructed. Every choice Laura Moss makes is exactly the choice she clearly wanted to make. And I'm sure maybe there were scenes that they cut out or maybe more she wanted to include. But I mean, it just feels so intentional. And mm-hmm. so it's daunting to try to get into that, because for a film that feels this intentional, especially as a male, it's difficult. I can observe and see, oh, that's dealing with this subject. And I can even discern, okay, this seems to be what it is saying about that subject. But what I love about the film is that it seems to be asking more questions than mm-hmm. it is handing out, doling out answers. And I just find that endlessly fascinating. We've touched on it, but like some of the subjects this thing deals with is like medical malpractice and class system, and it deals with reproductive rights, and it deals with ethics in and it deals with life and death. I was about to say ethics in medical practice, and it deals with just the burden of trying to be a person in the world, and very specifically the burden of trying to be a woman in the world when so much of these pressures and so many of these expectations are swirling around you. And I found it to be an incredibly profound film that I think I am, even, you know, two viewings in, still trying to wrap my head around everything. And I probably will be for the next couple of decades, you know, as I think back about this film and revisit it, which I'm sure I will, about all the different things that it has on its mind. But yeah, like we've all said, I would say I love this film, but not in the same way that I love, like, you know, Beetlejuice. You know, it's different. Right. It's very different.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, the tone is very heavy, but I really admire tremendously. To say that I merely admire a film implies I wouldn't like it. That's why I also say I love it, but it is a love of admiration. And Laura Moss is a filmmaker I'm going to be watching for years to come because I'm very impressed with this. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to, it's hard to know exactly how to engage with what the film has on its mind. Do you mind, before I pivot back to either Jose or Vera or maybe even Nathan, if you've got a strong starting point, can I get a few plot points out of the way to give listeners who may not see the film yet? I'm not going to do an entire plot summary, but just a few shared language plot points so that we can know what we're referencing. I will be as brief as possible, but fundamentally you start with this single mom. She became a mother, as she mentions at one point, through IVF. So there's no father figure, parental figure in the picture. She's struggling to make ends meet. She is a nurse. And one day she goes to work and her daughter is sick. I don't know if presumably her daughter would have gone to school, is what I'm presuming, or some version of childcare. But her daughter is sick, so she leaves her with the neighbor. And then through the course of the day, her phone falls into the toilet, just mm-hmm. complete accident, and her phone breaks. So then the neighbor she left her with can't reach out to her to let her know your daughter is severely sick. And we find out dreadfully late for the mother that her daughter had died of bacterial meningitis, which just completely obliterated her body. So then while she's dealing with this tragic loss, the mortician who receives her daughter, we then learn she's very perhaps sociopathic. She's got, she's very socially awkward.
So
yeah, go ahead.
I just want to interject real quick. Got from her, and this is another thing that I appreciated with subtlety, because a lot of movies feel like if you have a person, like if you have a gay person, they have to be flaming. If you have this, they have to be like, sure. Hey, yeah. I'm this character. I'm the token, right. Whatever. I think that she's neurodivergent 100%, mm-hmm. Possibly even on the spectrum. Sure. And yeah. I, just by the way she was acting, not really having great like eye connection with communication, a lot of the line delivery was done in a very specific way. And I'm a teacher. I may have mentioned this on the last pod, but I have I've had many students who have autism and in the past, and it reminded me a lot of the way they would they would speak and the way they would react in certain sure. situations, and even down to the fact that when you have something that is like something that you enjoy, you enjoy it so intensely, it like kind of is more important to you than literally anything else. And that very clearly is something that she was doing as well. So
sure.
again, we yeah. don't know for sure. She could just be socially awkward, but that was something I thought was important and interesting as well, is that she intentionally yeah, yeah. like went with that character being a more like clearly neurodivergent character.
Yeah. No, I really appreciate you interjecting that, because I do think that's important. It plays an important role to how she navigates the world. But we learn that what she has been doing is that she has been researching a way to defeat death, basically. And so when she receives the body of this child who has died, she's a match. She's been using, as the plot summary said, she's been using basically fetal tissue to try to defeat death. And so she successfully brings this little girl back to life. Well, the mother of that girl, who never got to see her daughter's body, puts puzzle pieces together, follows this mortician home. And then when she discovers what's been happening with her daughter, kind of, you know, as you would expect, she joins in. Like, she's like, okay, well, I'm here. I live here now. Like, this is, you know, I am now going to be with my daughter. She's never going to be alone. And then just to fast forward through some other major highlights, at a certain point, the mortician's ability, she has been impregnating herself, and she's been using her own fetal tissue for this concoction that she's making that can, again, defeat death. At a certain point, she has a kind of a tragic miscarriage and is unable to continue to conceive. She's unable to continue to produce this.
She has a hysterectomy.
Material. Yeah, yeah, she has a hysterectomy.
Yeah, I think they said before the procedure was she had gotten an infection in her cervix, and then that led to the, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. So after that, and this is where the film edges into really boundary-pushing territory. So they decide that they are going to bring in a currently pregnant patient and bring them in for, is the procedure an amniocentesis? Is that what it's called? So they bring in this woman, recognizing that they're about to subject this innocent woman to massive concerns about her pregnancy, distress, but they are going to collect her tissue because they discovered that she's a match to be able to keep this experiment going. And then, yeah, we can save the ending for maybe another point in the conversation, but pardon me for taking that time. I just wanted to get some shared language as we navigate different subjects, different themes, so we knew some major plot points of it. But yeah.
Reed, let me throw in there only because it's slightly relevant to how articulate you got with that. So what they do with the patient is draw amniotic fluid. You know, it is a different, like, that will function in the same way that the fetal tissue had been. So there is a little bit of a distinction between what they're drawing from her and what they were providing previously. But nonetheless, yeah, I mean, it's funny. Y'all's sort of takes on the film earlier, and just say, I think part of the way you described this made me think of it. Like, I don't know that I had the conscious thought, because again, I knew nothing going into it. I don't know that I had the conscious thought early in the film, oh, this is a rather feminist tale, and I'm getting a peek inside this sort of psychology and sort of wherewithal of this. But it was more subtle than that. But by the end, you do, and by you, I mean me, you do feel like you're hearing another language that you're comprehending, you know, but is still not really your native tongue. That's a fair way to put it. But, you know, something I've always, it's come up multiple times on even the show before, but just, I have just generally speaking, kind of an openness to perspective. And, like, you know, this film really pushes. It's funny because I know, and maybe I don't want to dwell too hard on the, you know, semantics of it all, but just say you'd mentioned not being sure if you would categorize this as horror. Well, the director definitely does. Like, they multiple times refer to it as body horror. And it's fascinating to see.
I could see it.
You know, to me, how I would have before this film described body horror was, isn't it gross what we can do to bodies, right? Like, that's how I would have maybe defined it. Whereas this kind of turns out on its head of, aren't what bodies are capable of interesting, odd, curious, sometimes gross, endlessly fascinating, right? Like, that's kind of what this is sort of after.
The horror for me, I was thinking more so about all of the, like, the importance of the film, I guess, more so than the
sure.
It's ideas of it, yeah, right? No,
I'm agreeing with that.
Sure.
Yeah, definitely the horror was like the like, now that I think about it, it's like, yeah, there was a lot of guts and stuff. I guess I just didn't really think about it. Is that weird? I don't know. But the horror of the human experience is kind of, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like a lot of the horror was psychological in this one for sure. Like how far will you truly go to save your child? How far will you take it to complete your one task that you feel you have to complete in your life? Like, you know, which that's a scary thought, you know?
Yeah. Nathan, you had mentioned that it took a little while for the more feminist themes to come to the surface for you. When I was watching the movie quite close to the beginning, mm-hmm. The mother is helping deliver a baby, and the mm-hmm. doctor in the scene very offhandedly just says, like, the pregnant person who's on the table is pushing, and she wants to continue pushing, and the doctor's like, let's just do the episiotomy.
And she said in her ear, right? Yeah, right.
And she's like, I don't want to. I want to keep pushing. And then the nurse advocates for the pregnant woman, and the doctor says, okay, try again. And so that's something that I picked up on right at the beginning, that this nurse is allowing this woman's voice to be heard in the most vulnerable moment that she's probably been through up until this point. And is something that within, you know, like mom blogs and other things like that, is something that is discussed quite often. People with concerns regarding their birth plans and stories regarding traumatic birth where they weren't listened to. And so that it was mm-hmm. something I picked up on right away that, this mm-hmm. is something that the film is going to have on its mind. And then with what happens to her daughter and how she goes from being a fierce advocate for a pregnant woman to what she does to Emily at the end. And that turn is the most horrific part of the movie to me.
There was almost like a role reversal as well, to some extent. Like, we start off with Celie being the more touched, like, you know, kind of sensitive, like, ooh, I don't know about that. And then by the end, she's like, I'm going to do literally anything. And then Dr. Casper, Rose, at the beginning was very stoic, very like, this is my job. And she starts to smile. She starts to kind of get drawn to the humanness of the whole thing. And she even puts her foot down and says, no, like, that's the end. But the one who's, you know, at the beginning was so, I don't know about this, ends up being the one who pushes it to that, like, even further, to the point where she kills that other woman. So I found that was
a hard turn when mm-hmm. when you realize what she has done, like, oh God. I'm curious, from Vera and Jose, Vera, I'll come to you first, and then Jose, feel free to throw in some ideas here, because for someone who is observing a language being spoken that is not one's native tongue, but still appreciative of trying to remain open and conscientious and considered of hearing the language spoken, I'm curious, again, in order, Vera, Jose here, like, what do you think the movie is, or the story, or the movie as it's telling its story? Is it, I'm going to use words that are going to fail me here of what I'm trying to get to. Like, is it hopeful? Is it dour? Is it tragic? Is it celebratory? Is it all of these things? Like, what is the point of view that as we reach home plate here at the end of the film, and to very briefly, I referenced this earlier, Celie kind of co-opts this pregnant woman's life because they need this amniotic fluid. The woman dies. But what you see is a repetition of visual images from the very beginning of the film that you didn't know were, you know, going to be to reappear. That's a real poor way to describe it. But pivoting to you, Vera, here, like, what do you think is the point of view of the film? Like, what does that even question conjure for you?
I don't know. Like, I have ideas about that I took away from the film, but I don't know what the film wants to tell me about these things, other than they are realities. for women.
Well, I guess for me, and then I'll come to you, Jose, there, bridging this gap of like, because that is something I struggled with after the fact, not in judgment of the film, but in like, what are you wanting me to understand? Is it just plight? Is it, hey, appreciate because, right? And so that's what spawns kind of the question. But Jose, what do you feel in response to that?
Again, I think, as Riad had said earlier, I think, you know, she's very intentional about the way this was written, about the way this was made, about everything, really. And I think that us having this conversation and wanting to know more about it even is intentional. Like, I think that she specifically wanted to include all of these things. I think overall, in general, it's trying to say, like, I don't think it's saying feel bad for women, because we don't want people to feel bad for us.
Sure. Yeah.
That's not what we want. But it definitely is saying, I think it's just saying, this is the quintessential female experience in these specific examples, and they show it in different ways, many of them horrifying, because the reality is, being a woman, specifically in America, is horrifying in lots of ways. And they dramatized it a little bit and added a little flavor with the, you know, the whole scientific plot of bringing the daughter back to life, obviously. But I think the overall theme was more, I think it was intentionally vague. I think it was just like, hey, this is what women deal with. And this is a horror movie, but this is also real. And yeah, I want you to leave thinking about how real these things really are.
Yeah. Not pity us, but understand. Just understand that this is reality.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to jump in there just a second, because I do think the impetus can try to be, Nathan, I want to hang a big, big, bright, shiny lantern on. I am not saying you were doing this deliberately, because I think we're just raising good questions. The impetus can be in any version of reception of a film, in any version of reception of a story. Oh, well, what is it trying to say? What am I supposed to take away from this?
Oh, of course.
And what I have recently, it's perhaps an experiment in film criticism and in story criticism, but I have recently tried, listeners who heard our Skinamarink episode will probably get some flavor of what I've been on here, which is more about, this is a story, this is what happened. And it can be so, because we want to make sense of our lives, right? We want to make sense. I want to know the plot point when I was 12 that led me to the breakthrough when I was 30, that led me to the interaction when I was, you know, 38 and stuff like that. And the reality is, there are so many things that it is at the same time. The fact that what she is doing for her daughter can simultaneously be kind of lovely and kind of repulsive. I'm talking about the Carla from Scrubs. What is her character?
No, I keep wanting to call her Carla, because and her name's also Seeley in the movie.
Seeley, Judy Reyes. Which so that it doesn't go unsaid, we haven't gotten into a lot of like didactic specific. Holy shit, these performances. These two performances.
So good. Yeah.
I mean, volcanic acting performances from Aaron Island and Judy Reyes. Incredible performances. So that note out of the way, I think it can be so tempting to look at it and try to say, oh, well, we're bridging the complexity. We're landing on a place. And there's an openness to recognizing, like, these things are multiple things simultaneously. That it's simultaneously oppressive and empowering. That you talked about this role reversal, that even the characters we are introduced to have become very different things by their end. What started as someone who would somewhat fiercely advocate for someone with barely much thought when her daughter dies, ultimately, with barely much thought, is like, I am going to rip the agency from this other woman. I'm going to lie to her. I'm going to go to her home under the pretense of thoughtfulness, and I'm going to drug her tea and murder
abduct her.
Like,
yeah.
Well, and yes, I will say, directly, she didn't intend to murder her.
That's true. She says that
was right accidental.
Out, right. Yes.
However,
yes.
It did happen. You know, I mean, it still mm-hmm. it still happened. But yes, I do remember that she had said, like, I didn't mean to kill her. But
and what she absolutely does is rob that woman of her agency. You know,
yes.
Like she completely takes that away from her. And and then I think the film's final moment is so dang powerful, because what we're left with at the end, it's a birth. Like, that's what we're left with at the end of the film. You know, like the little girl opens her eyes and sees her mother, which visually is very reminiscent of the opening shots of the film.
Mm-hmm.
Where, you know, we're seeing, you know, the trauma close up on Emily. We don't realize what's happening right then, because the film doesn't tell us until the end. But, you know, I feel like, getting back to your question and getting back to why it's so difficult to sort of enter into this film, is because this film will not, it resists every categorization that we would love to put around it, because it is so many things simultaneously. It speaks to the complexity of these experiences. And I think part of its intention is to rattle away. One of the things that frustrates me, as this is, of course, as a male, but also just as a human being, I largely despise the tidiness of complicated issues when people want to reduce very complex, very nuanced, very important kind of subjects, and they want to reduce them to sound bites, or they want to reduce them to headlines. I get very repulsed in myself, where somebody's like, oh no, it's really simple, it's just this, and I'm like, dude, I guarantee you right now, the way you just broadly categorized and dismissed that, I guarantee you there are hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of people who are living an experience that would undermine your tidy, self-arrogant kind of assessment of this very complex subject. Because, and we said this on the show before, because when, you know, whatever policy someone supports or denies, we've said before on the show that when the policy becomes a person, the game changes. Like, once it is a living being who is moving through this situation, then kind of all bets are off. And I think this film is so good at showing you very real three-dimensional characters navigating these tensions in very complex ways. Like the way, I'll say this and then I promise I'll shut up. the way after her daughter dies and Paulina, I think, or the Paola, neighbor. I forget, the neighbor. Yeah. Mm-hmm. She's with her, you know, and then, you know, she expresses a very sincere, I'm not leaving you, mija. You know, and then she just looks over, get the F out of my face. You know, mm-hmm. like, that was such a real moment to me right there. Like, this, you know, whose fault is any of this? Does that even matter at this point? And that's the intelligence and the maturity that I think this film exhibits, is how untidy any of it is. But again, very, as we've said so many times, very deliberate and very intentional, just not at all neat, not at all simple. I want to, because I have curiosities, but I want to take a breath to see, was there anything, Jose, you have a lot of notes, Vera, I'm sure you're always so thoughtful with everything. So I have curiosities that I don't know if we'll have time for or not, but I want to just kind of give some runway to what stood out to either of you about this film that that you'd like to say a word or two about, or ask a question or two. We went to Vera first last time. Jose, I'll come to you.
Well, to kind of lighten the subject, I thought it was cute that she named the pig Muriel after her mom. I thought that was very sweet and precious.
There were like really like almost like surprising funny moments throughout.
Yeah. So, and I was thinking while Reed was talking there, like so many lighthearted moments too, to just, there was so much about this film is like grounded in reality. And just when something gets horrific, they do something that's so touching, like the scene with the daughter in the bathtub where she's singing to her. And she remembers the open, shut them, open, shut them. And she started singing it. I almost cried. I literally almost cried when I was watching that scene, because in that moment, you're like, oh my gosh, like, not only does this mean her, like, from a scientific standpoint, her brain, oh, her brain's working. No, that it's more than that. It means her mind is connecting back to those memories she had with her mother. And she recognizes her mother, knows that's her mother, and wants to be with her. Like, when her mom was in the bath later, she was like going like this at the door, like, clearly, you know, and oh my gosh, like, so many little moments like that in there too. I think the, we had mentioned how I was pretty sure they had made Marin Ireland's character Rose, Dr. Casper, intentionally neurodivergent. And some of her, I wish I had written some of her quotes down, because some of her quips she had made, like when somebody said something to her and she said something back, were really funny to me. Just like, when her and Rose and Celie are kind of getting into it, she has a glass in her hand, she drinks it, and she goes, "This glass is dirty." Like,
yeah.
Had nothing to do with what they were talking about. And she's like, well, I think she said, you know, we'll wash the dishes or something, you know, something like right. that. And, right. you know, we'll get over there and do it. And, but, you know, to her, it's something that stuck out, you know, this is gross. This is, because, you know, that's how
it does have a kind of odd couple angle on it. That's really,
mm-hmm. Yeah. Just like the little stuff or, what do you, you know, walking in, it reminded me and my husband, like they, you know, she, what do you mean you forgot to do that? And then storms in and just does it for them. Like, you know, I feel like we've all been there at some point. Like,
There's I would just throw this little comment out there, because I do think it's there becomes, I'm so shy. There becomes this invisible umbilical cord between the two of them, that is, they are feeding off of each other, and I think there's this fascinating way in which they take on each other's personalities, but they begin to become like each other as the more the film goes on. Like, I think Jose, you commented on that it's like, that Dr. Casper's character becomes more like Celie, and Celie becomes a little bit more detached, like
Rose begins to warm up to her, and then starts like telling her about how, I think they had a conversation about, that was kind of the meeting point, the merriment of, like, before the complete reversal, where they had the conversation over coffee, of it was coffee or tea, of when, like, when did you first start doing this? And Rose starts talking about, well, I was 5 or 6 years old, and she told the starfish story about how her mom was a biology teacher or something like that, and she had cut off the leg, and then she tried cutting off the hamster's leg, and she, like, spit out her coffee, and like, you know, because she was just saying this so nonchalant, and
she's recalling it as like a pleasant memory.
Yeah, she was smiling while she was saying all of this, and she's just kind of like, what the f-? But that moment right there, I think, was like the middle, like, personality wise, before Rose starts kind of not like regretting her choices, but starts realizing, I can't keep going. Like, it's not human. It's not right to continue going like this, because it's going to keep escalating. Right. And then after that, that's when Celie started doing the opposite, doing like, well, this isn't enough, because I have to do what I can for my daughter, and what we're doing right now is not enough, you know?
Yeah. Well, there's that definite break narratively and thematically when Rose has her hysterectomy. I think you hit it, Jose, that, like, after that point, they do immediately, well, not immediately, but very, very quickly swap places to where now Rose is ready to grieve and mourn the inability to proceed, and Celie is like, oh no, that we are not going there, we're gonna continue and proceed.
Well, and even seeing Rose's reaction to being told she couldn't have a child was kind of what went through my mind there is like thinking about women who experience that truly, yeah, and trying to have babies however they want to have babies, you know. But you know, her reaction to that in that moment, it felt like, after kind of seeing this character kind of grow and change, like it felt in that moment, at least to me, like she really almost regretted at that point, was like, oh, I like, that's really, this is really bad. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, you, I don't know if she necessarily wanted to be a mom, but just by her reaction and how distraught she was when she grabbed the chart and looked at it and kind of the look on her face and everything, just kind of, it like said a lot without saying it. You know what I mean?
Oh, and I think I'll say this, and then Vera, I want to give you similar runway to share some thoughts on that, you know, that potential grief of, well, now, you know, she can't conceive. She is unable to do this anymore. That moment when she comes out of the shower and the little girl, don't know the little girl's name either.
Leela. Yeah.
Leela has killed the pig. Leela has killed Muriel. Mm-hmm. And Rose comes out. That moment that they share together, where Leela is like fascinated by her scar, from like, she's fascinated by,
yeah, like the staples on there,
the staples, yeah. And that moment, you talk about the matronliness of it, a little bit of that stuck out to me in that moment, that like, yeah, she will never experience that except as a facilitated ruse, a facilitated facade that like, that she has manufactured for herself. Anyway, Vera, what are, yeah, similar runway, go wherever you want to go.
In regard to the bathtub scene, I also thought it was a really beautiful, like, pivotal moment. And then I was like, but why is she singing the tune to that song wrong? And it was like nailed on a chalkboard to me. It's like, oh, why, yeah, is she singing Open Shut Them to the tune of Frère Jacques? It's just because
this
I sing it a lot.
Not a very well considered movie.
Yeah, I did it with my pre-K students, and I didn't do it that way either. But I was like, I don't know.
Yeah. The two things that I came away thinking most strongly about, number one was, I don't think that Rose had a desire to become a mother. Mm-hmm. In the traditional sense, I think that, right, she valued her body's capability to do what it was doing because it was feeding her baby, which was her project, her experiment.
Mm-hmm.
And when she lost the ability to procreate, in the natural sense, she lost the ability to support her child.
It was kind of her livelihood. That's all she really cared about. Because when she was speaking to her boss about, like, well, what do you do? And she's like, oh, I read and I do this and I do this. And she goes, "That and that's enough for you?" Like, it was very clear, like, that's really all she cared about was this project that she now put her body into, literally, you know?
And she was literally putting her body into it, right? Mm-hmm. And and so I think that the grief was surrounding that. And I think that that is something that women experience in a lot of different ways, but like, just your body is supposed to be able to perform a function that it now can't, it isn't performing in the way that the biology should, and the grief that follows with that. But I think that one of the strongest points in the movie is the danger of viewing medicine as strictly science and removing the humanity from it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is, I mean, I live here in Canada where like Roe versus Wade is not a law that is applicable up here. We have our separate laws.
It's not here either.
Well, sorry. Oh. Wow.
Sorry.
No, that's okay. Womp womp. So that's awful. But
we laugh so we don't cry.
Laugh, I was gonna say, right, laugh through the pain.
and we also while we do have like protections in place for procedures, we also have a society that I think, because of this, the socialism up here and our system, we support women and families in a way that doesn't exist so much mm-hmm. in the US. And so it's a lot easier to be, it's just, we've recognized that there's a humanity in pregnancy, and that's, mm-hmm. that women who are the ones who are giving birth, the children, they're both valuable, and we need to yeah. provide them with supports in order for this process to take place. And so the humanity, it's not viewed at strictly in black and white form, but right. as you mentioned, Reed, that like the human aspect is considered. And I think that that's something that is important mm-hmm. and should always be important. The second thing I thought of while I was watching the movie was My Sister's Keeper. Do you guys, have you read the book yeah. or watched the movie?
Mm-hmm. No,
and the ethics of, sorry?
No, I just saying that one's new to me. I don't know it.
And the ethics of save your siblings. So the book and movie are both about a girl named Kate who has a form of leukemia, and their parents conceive a second child that the genetics have been made to be similar to the first daughter, and the intent is that the second daughter will provide the older daughter with the medical things that she needs. So blood transfusions, wow. bone marrow.
She's just, yeah.
And yeah. and eventually the parents request that she donates a kidney to her older sister. And then the story focuses on her struggle to emancipate herself from her parents mm-hmm. so that she can make her own medical decisions. And it's wow. discovered later on, spoiler alert for My Sister's Keeper, sorry, that it's actually the sixth sister who has told her to go through this process to emancipate herself because the sixth sister doesn't want her sister to suffer.
Mm.
And the book and movie end in different ways, but the concept of while Rose's fetuses that she is intentionally conceiving and aborting are not siblings of Leela, technically, they are similar enough genetically that one is supporting the other. And the ethics behind intentionally conceiving in order to destroy, in order to support another life was mm-hmm. something that I thought was, I don't think is something that is discussed enough. Because while usually save your siblings are born children, I think that psychologically they suffer and their families suffer and the sick child suffers in ways that we don't talk about enough.
There is a lot of just purely ethical questions that could be raised on so much of this movie.
That was what I felt when I was watching it, is I felt like it was engaging this conversation about ethics in one of the most mature ways that I'd seen any film do it. So often I feel the subject treated as, and I'm not even criticizing this when I say this, as like popcorn camp, you know, extremity kind of thing. This is really, this one has a capacity to really unnerve you because of the ramifications of what you now have to contend with, you know, of like, oh my God. Like, I feel like it put, this is going to sound perhaps silly initially, but this is my perception. My perception is that we have lived with Mary Shelley's novel Frankenstein for so long now that what Dr. Victor Frankenstein is conceiving to do is plastic and is so non-transgressive to us. Like, oh, he just wants to resurrect the dead, you know? And so we've lived with it for so long that any mad scientist with wild hair and an electric shock, you know, apparatus, we're just like, oh yeah, he just wants to raise the dead. And we no longer have an emotional response to it. And what I appreciate and admire so much about this film is this film manages to find a way into the story that rattles you again, that makes you, I feel like maybe contemporary audiences who read Frankenstein when it was first released might have felt about the ethical and the inhuman horror of that. You know, like when Celie says at one point off the cuff, she's like, this is like a miracle. And of course, Rose is very confrontational with that.
Yeah, don't call it that.
Yeah, this is this is science and hard work over time, you know? Mm-hmm. And what I thought when I was watching that is there is a component to all of this of what I would call a soul, both the erosion of it as you make mm-hmm. choices over time, the loss of it or transition of it when we die, and the value or importance of it when considering just navigating humanity in the world around us. And I feel like it was just, I feel like this film powerfully, I say this deliberately, that the film very powerfully challenged preconceived notions about all of those different subjects. Like, oh, you think, you know, Frankenstein is just some glib story about a doctor who decides he's going to resurrect the dead. And it's like, well, look at this. And how far would you go? And what if it were your child? And, you know, all of those different ramifications. Because, I mean, when I rewatched it, I mean, yeah, sure, whatever. It's not the only night that I've ever done this. But when I rewatched it, it was late. And I went and sat on my son's bed for a little bit and just sat with him with my hand on, you know, his back and just sat there and just took it in for a second. Not because the film, you know, was making me, well, the film was having an effect on me, but just to sit in the moment and just, okay, I'm not going to say anything. I'm not going to endow this moment with any sort of deliberate meaning. I just want to sit here with my hand on my son's back and be present for that.
Well, Henry, you hit on something that I thought about after our Branagh conversation. Listener, 2 weeks ago, go check it out. We covered 1994's Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. And something that I thought about in watching that, having never read the text, is the curiousness that is Victor Frankenstein from Geneva's quest is beget by the loss of his mother. Like, that's the inciting incident, which, hear me, no one wants to lose a parent, but it is natural for your parent to go before you. Mm-hmm. And what, to your point, makes this film almost more Frankenstein than Frankenstein is to lose a child is, in the traditional sense, unnatural. So mm-hmm. it is an unnatural act, an unnatural occurrence that mm-hmm. they are now trying to unwind. And that becomes the fascinating focal point, as opposed to, again, it's funny, it didn't occur to me in the moment when we were having that conversation, but later on I was like, what? I mean, don't get me wrong, like, I don't want to lose my mama, but, and I'll be sad when that happens, but it's kind of supposed to happen, you know? like in terms of order, sequence of events. Yeah. I think that's what's really fascinating about this one.
Yeah, and I think kind of yes-anding you a bit, I thought too when I was watching this film, but this is something I think about a lot. But, you know, this film didn't necessarily put it on my mind, but it's certainly exploring it about, you know, how completely averse we are to the role of death in who we are, just as a species. And I don't have a pithy bumper sticker slogan thing to attach to that. I just know we are so averse to contemplating, I'm going to say it deliberately, contemplating its value to us. I'm not saying, oh, it's a good thing, it's an important thing. I'm not even saying the opposite of that either. I just know we don't think about it very often. We spend a lot of time trying to avoid it, to cheat it, to try to, you know, live in denial of it. You know, it was very much on my mind, the notion, and has been for a while now, the notion that we sit in a place where we believe this will, you know, the future ahead of us will be the perpetual state for a while. So, you know, I, sitting right here talking with you three lovely people, it's difficult for me to contemplate me suddenly suffering a debilitating illness that irrevocably changes my state of life. It's difficult for me to put myself in that place. And what would I do if I were put in that place, and potentially unethical solutions to put me back were presented to me? And I tell you, I do not. There's a line from Lord of the Rings that I'm going to very poorly quote because I didn't prepare to talk about it, where Gandalf is about to enter the mines of Moria, and he says, "There are forces here against which I have not been tested." And I feel like there is a tremendous amount of profound, not from any of you lovely people, but there's a tremendous amount of pontificating happening out in the world about things against which their ethics have not been tested. So people mm-hmm. can talk very braggadociously about how they feel about this subject or that subject or women's rights or any version I'm trying to conjure political and social ills at the time, where people will stand on their platforms and pound their fists and say, this is the way it is. And I think that so often, I was like, have you, because I can hear the language that you're using, have you been tested against that subject? And I usually doubt it when somebody speaks very glibly and very crassly about subjects that are so clearly beyond their mettle. They have not crossed through that threshold, because people who then speak about the same subject, and maybe with equal conviction, but you can just hear the humility of having gone through it, because they've actually walked through the process, because they actually know the landscape of it, because they were pushed into it. And I think a film like this, the reason I'm thankful for it is because I think it does push you into that kind of landscape and say, like, well, you never thought about this subject in this way, did you? Like, you never thought about the same exact categories with this overlay. And I think that is a profoundly healthy exercise to try to do. Pause for effect.
Okay. So, effect achieved.
So just wanted to burst the tension in the air just for a minute. But I do want, before we potentially, you know, I do feel like this film deserves to be talked about for hours. We're not going to do that on this podcast, but I feel like it deserves to be talked about. And I don't often say this, like, this is the kind of film that I would love to watch with a specific and refined group of people, and then all go out and over some drinks, like, just unpack it with personal stories and with, you know, thoughtful explorations about certain things, because I feel like the film invites that.
I appreciate movies that make you think and make you talk. I think it's great to have a succinct ending. I think it's great to have like a, oh, happy or oh, sad. And that's all good and all. But I think there's something very powerful about a movie that ends on a question mark and kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that another power of this movie, too, is that while we, the viewer, are watching and we impose the societal laws and ethics that we have in place onto the movie, and we make a judgment within the context of the movie, like, there isn't judgment really passed from one to the other, like, because the role of the two women switch over time to one being more compassionate to less compassionate and vice versa. And like the actions that they are taking and why they are taking them being reasons that you could empathize with. Like, yeah. I don't feel like it is judgmental towards the characters in the film, but I think that it is open, like, just the number of topics of discussion that you could have in regard to the situation within the film and within society at large that it mirrors is astounding. Like, it's a feat. It's impressive.
Oh, yeah.
Can I read this quote from the director?
Yeah.
So I was reading this earlier. It's from an interview that she did, and they asked the question, and I feel like this is a good, you know, kind of summation, kind of, but it says, with the themes that it tackles and having two female leads, Birth Rebirth fits perfectly in the boom of female-centered body horror we seem to be enjoying. What is it that you think attracts us to these stories? She says, I think it's a two-part question, because why are the films emerging? Why are the audiences responding? I would say the films are emerging because some of us had not previously gotten a break are now getting that break. We're not that far removed from a famous horror producer saying that there are no female filmmakers to be found in the horror genre, which, wow, side note, that was a real thing that was said in it.
Wow.
Makes my blood boil. And since that time, we have been given the chance as a fan, we have been given the chance. I'm really grateful to Shudder for being given the chance to make this unconventional horror movie. But as a fan and as a queer lover of horror, okay, so queer confirmed. So that kind of was probably true. I rarely saw myself in the genre. I stuck with it anyway because I love horror. It tells the truth about things that people don't want to talk about. It brings up sticky, difficult situations in life that polite society would rather avoid. It's an open secret that our audiences have been more queer and more femme than the mainstream would believe, and it's just a relief to see yourself reflected a little bit more in the genre that you love.
Mm. Yeah,
so
that's important.
Yeah, it just, after reading that, I was like, I have to share that because that just shows like how, again, it's just proving how important this film was to her to kind of get it out there. And like I said, I just, the more I think about it, and even just after us talking about it and watching it for the second time before this and stuff, it just really makes me, yeah, I hope she makes more stuff.
Oh, no, absolutely. And I feel
if this has this much to say and she does it like this and does it so well, I am very excited to see what else she can do. Because
absolutely.
Well, apparently she's got a couple of, so that little interview I was watching, Maren Ireland, she references them really getting on the same wavelength and talking about prepping for this film and trying to get cast, but they became good buddies. So even Ireland references, you know, it would have stunk to not get cast, but we'd really become friends at that point, so it didn't really matter. But she does reference a couple of short films, I think, and I'll just name drop them here because I haven't watched them, didn't even know they exist till shortly before us talking this evening. But one, I think it's called Friday, but then the one that they kept ribbing each other on, it's called Porn Without Sex. So, you know, do with that what you will. But that was one of the short films that, you know, apparently kind of put her on the map. Just say thank you for sharing that. Sincerely, that was a really, really great quote to throw in the mix here. Y'all, come on. Like, what? Geopolitics, you know, healthcare systems, you know, like alternate perspectives. We have clearly forgotten that we're a horror show. So, you know, if it's gory, if it's gross, if it causes you a fright, what scares you about this movie? What makes you say, that ain't right? That ain't right, it ain't right, nothing right about it. No, that ain't right, no, that ain't right, no, that ain't right, it ain't right. It sure is hell ain't right, it sure is hell ain't right. That ain't right, that ain't right, that sure as hell ain't right.
Oh, snap. Right.
Oh, snap, indeed. All right, Jesse, I know you've got a particular sort of lens you use for your That Ain't Right, so I'm very curious. I'm going to let you go first. What might have made your list for Birth, Rebirth? One thing, okay? Vera's got her work cut out for her already with these, but one thing.
We're not going to have an action figure line for this one, are
no,
we?
You better
no,
not.
Oh, no. Jesus.
Come on. I may be dumb, but I've got taste, you know. I can keep it classy when needed. So, Jesse, what would you categorize as a That Ain't Right for you?
So, as I mentioned last time I was on the pod, for me, it's hard to get me with some stuff. I don't often get squeamish. I'm thinking about the practical effects that they have to do to kind of do these scenes and stuff. So, kind of, I was thinking of this before the pod, like, what am I going to say for That Ain't Right? And there was only one time in both viewings, it happened the second time also, where I like physically got up. I was sitting in my desk chair because we were watching on Discord on my computer. I got up in my seat and was hugging my knees. It's whenever they do the marrow. Thing, and she sticks that big ass thing in her back and turns it and just, and you could see her face, like, just ooh, like, oh my gosh, that needles in general, and like that kind of that specific thing just is a trigger for me. But okay. that scene was very hard for me to watch. Yeah, oof. That's mine.
Well, see, there. No, I appreciate you sharing that, because now we're getting the real Jose. Like, you're like, I don't, you know, practical effects, I can see through it. Yeah. Needles. That's it. We found it. That's yeah, Jose's. Like, that ain't right.
Saw, it's gonna be a theme. Needle pit.
Mm-mm. Sure. Yeah. 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 Bone marrow. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Reed, what about you?
Me? Oh, yeah. You're not gonna let. Oh, okay.
I'm just keeping you on your toes, man.
Yeah, you sure are. Okay. Well. The aspect, there's this one scene where I think it's either the second, maybe third, God help, maybe fourth time that Emily has come back for another amniocentesis, and
sorry, I think I know what you're gonna say.
Yeah, and the whole scene just gets at my gut, but it is either shortly thereafter. I think it is very shortly thereafter. After Celie has pointed out to Rose, we're about to put a 10-inch needle like right next to her baby's head. Like she's not going to tolerate that, you know. And then it is either the next scene or very, very shortly thereafter that the camera lets us see the ultrasound.
You see the needle
while
yeah.
it happens. And as I was watching that, I just felt, certainly couldn't have been the full force of it, but what seemed to me to be the full force of gravity of that moment of like, oh my God. So the film is very smart in that regard, because then when Emily begins to clap back, because she's like, okay, you're done. Am I? You know, like, yeah. And makes the comment about, you know, oh, you know, go to the good hospital, not the close one. You know, like you're on Emily. I was on Emily's side 100%. I was like, yes, I feel what seems like every inch of this. So that was that ain't right for me. It's just what they're putting Emily through in general. But I feel like that specific, like letting me see the ultrasound.
Yeah, was, seeing the baby's head with the needle just getting ever closer to the skull.
Like, yeah, and I kept thinking, like, God help if that baby jumps, you know, like just, you know, if the
it
baby
sneezes
just, like,
or something.
Yeah, I was just like, oh my God. So yeah, that's my that ain't right. It's just witnessing that on the ultrasound. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, sweet God. So yeah, that was mine.
Yeah.
I declined the amniocentesis all four times.
No, man, I'm not surprised.
Hard pass on that.
Yeah.
Can I cheat a little bit with mine?
Sure.
There are three moments of absolute heartbreak in the movie for me that for me just ain't right. The first is when Celie leaves Leela with the neighbor. And Leela's being a bit of a pill. Ooh. And she's like, if you don't behave yourself, I'm just going to go.
Oh,
and then she just turns and walks away and doesn't give her like a hug or a kiss or something. And then she dies. Awful. Absolute like choke in the throat. Awful. Makes you want to hug your kids. The second is when she's in the elevator with the Ziploc bag of Leela's clothes.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just awful. And the third is right at the end of the movie, and it has to do with Emily. When she's on the table and the C-section is happening, and Celie says to her, your baby's going to be okay. And Emily says, but what about me?
And no one responded.
And nobody responds to her.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
The female experience right there in the nutshell.
Those are three absolute gut punch moments for me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, God. That actor, this ostensibly should go somewhere other than that ain't right, but I don't know if anybody has seen the TV series Mr. Mercedes. It was, I watched all three seasons of it, largely loved all three seasons of it, but that actor, if I'm saying her name correctly, Breida Wool, she plays a prominent role in that series, and that's the first place I'd ever seen her. I've only ever seen her in that series, all three seasons, and in this film. But she's impressive. I think she has such a presence, and I was bowled over by her performance and everything I've seen her in. She carries such a vulnerability. At the same time, you know, she will be able to bite if she chooses to. And it's just, yeah, she's a very powerful performer. So yeah. Anyway, had to throw that in there. Nathan.
Yeah.
Avoid it no longer.
I can't. Y'all took a lot of the biggies here. I do think there's one that got left on the board that feels worth mentioning. You know, we've talked a lot about the grounded nature of this film and its tone, and I think this is very much in keeping with that. I got to be honest, you know, we talked about when we kind of clenched up, or when we, you know, when we winced, when mm-hmm. we squinted our eyes real tight. I got to be honest, when Celie drops her phone in the toilet, there are a few things more real and more.
I have 100% done that.
Live in fear of.
Yep. Same.
You know, mm-hmm. that than that. Like, it happened. And this movie is riddled with stuff. And that one happened. I was like, no.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I keep.
Oh, it's rough. Yeah. Anyway, so that one. In truth, though, that one isn't not in truth, but a non-jokey one is. I thought you were about to reference this, Vera, but for me, once you realize Celie has trapped Emily at the end or towards the end, it that was like, oh man, there's nothing left here to get them out of this quagmire.
The point of no return.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Oh God.
Yeah, so that has been did you squirm? Did you wince?
Yep.
Did you squint your eyes real tight? Did you drop your phone in the toilet?
Mm-mm-mm.
Well, it's probably because of what we around here call. That ain't right.
That sure as hell ain't right.
That ain't right. Oh, man. God, this movie. So, listen. I've loved so much of this conversation. I'm so appreciative. So, I will say this before we wrap up. I'm very appreciative, Jose and Vera, for your joining us on this. I badly wanted to talk about this film, and not just for, you know, propriety's sake, knew like I can't be dominant voice in this conversation. It's a film too important for that. So I very, very much appreciate you guys being here for this. And that brings us to our fog meter, our very specific way that we rate all the media that we cover on this show. We do so by giving it scores on what we call, as per the show's namesake, fear and God. Fear being defined as how disturbing, unsettling, scary, grotesque, all the nastiness with the film. And God, in how, like, what does this film have on its mind, and how effectively does it convey that? So, Vera, I'm going to start with you on fear and God. Two times in a row, you're just going to lead the charge. So, what would you give me both numbers? What would you give this film for its fear, and what would you give me for its God? 0 to 10.
For fear, I'm going to go for a 9. Just because I have been through pregnancy and I am a mother, and it just resonates very heavily with me. Mm-hmm. And then for God, a 10, because very obviously this movie has a lot it wants us to talk about on its mind.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Jose, what would you give it? You can give me both numbers, fear and then God.
For fear, I was more of a 5. I was thinking of it, I guess, in all aspects of horror, and while it was more like a super low score for actually, you know, scaring me,
sure,
or making me jump or things of that nature, making me wince, it wasn't really there for me during this movie, which is fine. It just wasn't. It was like a 10 in horrifying, like mentally, like sure, psychologically. So I'm just going to give it a 5 for that reason. Put it right smack in the middle.
Yep, gotcha.
And I'm with her on God. I give it a 10. I think that it, while it does have a lot of factors on its mind, I think that the way that the movie is done, it's done in such a way where it feels like, you know, there's a point, but the point is that they want you to talk about the points. You know what I mean? Like they want you to speak on these issues of that women go through, and that was very powerful. And I honestly don't know if it could be done any better. And so I think it deserves a 10 for that reason.
Awesome. Yeah. Oh, fantastic. Nathan, what would you give this film for Fear and for God?
It's funny. I will lead in with a brief story here that is relevant. And as not a person who has ever carried or delivered a child, I am married to one who has done so 3 times. And it was via C-section each time, which is a much different version of, but with our second child. So in the early part of this film, when you see it, her character's name is Emily, the patient.
Yes.
Yeah.
Redhead, yeah.
When you're seeing her, but don't know context for what you're seeing yet, it had a very visceral feeling for me because our second child and, you know, as the spouse of someone who had a C-section, you're present in the room and you're at their head while all of this stuff is going on. And for our second child, things started happening that were ultimately okay, but in the moment cause for alarm. And had a very, watching this movie, which again is not intended to cater to me and my sort of experience and sensibilities, like even just watching that scene that was 13 years ago, you know, had flashbacks to that experience and just the sort of visceral, the fear I felt of, you know, what might be happening right now, because I'm totally out of my depth and in this room and, you know, things are getting called out that I don't really understand. So anyway, I say all that to say, like, there was an added level and layer to experience in this film based on some of that experience. And so, you know, I think for even that personal aspect of it, coupled with just the truth of what it's presenting, I think from a fear standpoint, I'll go with a 7. It definitely avoids traditional horror points, a la Jose's Note, but, you know, still has a lot of that stuff baked in there. And I mean, I am not just following the crowd here. Like, if the definition of God for us on the fog meter is what is it after and how well does it achieve it, to give this a 10 feels almost like an undersell for how it accomplishes and achieves that particular note. So yeah, 7 and a 10 for me.
Sure. Heard. I'm gonna try to be brief here. So this film got in my brain. Like it dug its way in, it got under my skin. So I'm not gonna wax terribly poetic about this because it feels strange to do so given the subject of the film, but we all change over time. Like, we all go through degrees of, you know, I'm not the same person I was when I was 30, when I was 20, when I was 10. It's not a volcanic statement to say that, but I have experienced, to my memory, really at most 3, and I'm thinking of really, you know, the number one truly transformative experience. Like, moments before, I was one person. Moments after, I am another person. And that was when I witnessed the birth of our son. So my wife had a natural birth, a traditional birth, and I was present for all of it, and I bore witness to all of it. I have always been not terribly squeamish about the things bodies do. I won't get gross about that. I'm just saying, like, I've always been a person whose sensibilities are not terribly assaulted by the strange and sometimes lovely and sometimes, you know, offbeat things that our bodies do. So bearing witness to that was the first time that I can recall that I've ever experienced, the first time I saw my son's face was the only time I can recall that I've ever experienced speechlessness. Like I could not speak. Words came to my mind and I could not speak.
Yeah, Reed, not being able to speak, that's...
I'm glad you said
yes.
That.
Yes. Unheard yes. of. No, she's family, so she knows.
Oh yeah.
Like, so and so when this film is dealing with those subjects, even as a male, I can't enter into the, you know, the experience of being a woman. I can't enter into the experience of even bearing a child and something. I can only enter into the experience of bearing witness. And that was so transformative for me. So the things that this film is going to, it gets in my mind, it gets under my skin. For me, The Fear is a 10 is where I'm headed on this, because the questions it raises about how far you would be willing to go, what you would be willing to do. It for me, this is the rare kind of film that transcends, is it a scary film? Is it a disturbing film? I mean, it really taps into an experience that is likely to be very unsettling, troubling, provocative. And so, yeah, it's 10 for me on that. And come on, I'm not going to break the trend. Of course, it's a 10 for God. This film is masterfully put together, very much deserves. I mean, sure, I'm going to say, like, if we're talking top level horror of the year, of course, Your Talk to Me is going to be on there. Of course, Evil Dead Rise is going to be on there. Of course, you know, some of the other films that we've covered in our look back series deserve to be on there. But man, this film sits so to the side of all of those things, because it's just after something so different and achieves something really specific that I think is very, very powerful. And so all of that being said, again, the Fog Meter judges not the quality of the films, but rather the gravity, the heft, what they ask of you as the viewer. We give this film a 9 out of 10 on the Fog Meter. And it's rare these days for a film to get quite that high, but I think this one definitely deserves it. As we wind this down, I'm actually going to be deliberate here and let the ladies that are with us close our conversation, end the conversation, and have the final word on it. So, Nathan, I'm going to go to you first. Where are you at on this film after this conversation?
Well, as my note at the beginning of things of comprehending as the end is happening, it repeating imagery, like, it's not, quote unquote, a fun movie to watch, but it propels you into turning it right back on. And I kind of feel that sort of pull. I don't know how quickly I'd be able to accomplish that, but no, I think this conversation, is kind of the conversation we were meant to have about this movie. And so
yeah,
I'm very thankful for that.
Yeah. I'm gonna join you there. I've vastly appreciated this conversation. I appreciate getting to see this movie. I appreciate getting to talk about it. And it's a powerful film. It's not a film that I would recommend glibly or off the cuff, but it is a film that I would quite passionately recommend to anyone whose sensibilities I think could tolerate it. I think it deserves to be seen, to not put too fine a point on it. Jose, where are you at with this film after this conversation?
I definitely want to, I mean, I already, you know, I had a lot of this stuff kind of going through my head and things, but it makes me want to, like, definitely add it up there. I guess because I, not that I was concerned about how this conversation would go, but I definitely didn't know if we would try to, like, steer clear of the real,
sure,
the real tea that's going on, you know what I mean? But the fact that we did, and it went over so, almost so seemingly, you know what I mean? And I think we're those kind of people, let's be honest, like, we're just gonna vibe and hang, but, it makes me hopeful that this movie will withstand the test of time and continue to hopefully allow these conversations to continue to be had. And that is my hope, because that more movies like these that have, not like every movie has to have important things to say, but I think that movies like this that do it well, are needed, you know, just as much as we need our popcorn flicks, we need movies like this where it allows conversation like we're having, and I want it to keep going.
Yeah, wonderfully put. Wonderfully put. Vera, after this conversation, where are you at on this film?
I wish I could recommend it to more people. And I wish that it could be more mainstream. The fact that it's on Shudder, it's awesome that Shudder is doing things like that, but like I wish it could be found by a broader audience, because I think that the multifaceted examination of like womanhood and building and creating life and all that comes with that is such an important conversation that needs to be had. And I appreciate all of the sides that this movie considers. And I appreciate the conversation that we were able to have. And I want that for other people. I do not recommend it to pregnant women or women who have recently given birth.
Oh, yes.
Fair point. I was going to say, there's so many triggers in this that it would
there
be difficult.
There is a lot of triggers. Yeah. The hormones could not handle that.
Yeah. But, very fair point. Yeah. Well, thank you all so much. Loved this so much. And as we say on every episode, the fear of God is the beginning of wisdom, but it is not the end of the conversation. And in that spirit, we encourage you to fear nothing else and be on your way rejoicing. Jose, it was such a pleasure to have you back. Thank you so much for coming back and for watching this movie. Vera, it is always a pleasure to have you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Nathan, thank you as always. Oh, we appreciate that. And listeners, thank you so much for hanging with us. And next week, we are going to go to a film that, trust me, is not quite so oppressive as this one and heavy as this one can be. But definitely deals, as we have with this Frankenstein series, with some thoughtful subjects. We're going to a film called The Angry Black Girl and Her Monster. It is also available right now on Shudder. It will conclude our series on these recent emergent Frankenstein type stories. So please check that out if you haven't already. The Angry Black Girl and Her Monster next week. Thank you all again so much. We will see you all next week. Bye, everybody.
Bye. Gotta go hug my children.
I know. Oh, I know.
The fear of God is the beginning of wisdom, but not the end of the conversation. And you can continue the conversation in a variety of ways. Start by visiting thefearofgodpodcast.com for links to our social media and episode archive, essays, merchandise, and more. If you love what we do, consider becoming a patron by visiting patreon.com/thefearofgodpodcast, where you will unlock exclusive bonus episodes, extended standard episodes, online events, and so much more. Special thanks to Jacob Hunt of tracermatula.com for our artwork. Our assortment of talented musicians, Andrew Nelson, the Island Family, and Jackson Harper for our varied show tunes. And to Lee Wright and Reed Lackey for our theme music. Special thank you also to Tyler Smith at morethanonelesson.com. Lastly, be sure to subscribe to us on your podcast platform of choice. And if you listen to us through Apple Podcasts, we would greatly appreciate a rating and a review. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Hi, everybody.